My name's Gerald, and I'm 22. For the past year, I've encountered a buttload of crazy people and have accumulated even more crazy stories. While most of them would make you laugh, the one I've chosen to share was terrifying while it was happening, and still gives me shivers when I remember it. A little more than a year ago, I applied for and got a job at my favorite convenience store across the street from my house. I'd moved there my sophomore year in college and decided to stay after I left school. This little store has served as a savior to me. Living as young men often do, I had very little money, but I was always confident I could find something to fill my belly regardless of how much was in my pocket at the time. So, when the time came, I was no longer able to rely on my parents for money. The corner store was the first place I went for a job. I was in luck. Only the day before, one of the employees was fired for stealing from the register. I took his place, and I've been here ever since. Like any other corner store, we sell alcohol. Beer, wine, liquor, the whole boat. Naturally, this makes us a beacon for the local drunks. These folks have served as countless hours of entertainment. While most are harmless people, on one specific occasion, a horribly violent outburst occurred. It was a quiet Saturday night, about an hour before close. Most of the regulars had made their appearances, a few more than once. The two involved in this incident had been in around 7 p.m. and had just returned. They were, or at least appeared to be, a couple. I'd seen them around the neighborhood since I moved in. The owner of the store said they'd been customers since he bought the store, and that was 13 years ago. Although they were not very talkative when they came in, I never had any reason to believe either could be violent. However, that night something had changed. Upon arriving the second time, they went straight to the cooler containing the quart and 40-ounce size beers. Nothing out of the ordinary, as I said, but tonight an argument between the two started soon after their arrival. Initially, I couldn't hear what it was about, but soon I could hear everything they said across the store. I minded my own business for a while, but once the female began screaming curse words at the man, I felt like I had to at least get them to take it outside. I wasn't sure what to say, but I began my walk to the opposite side of the small store. Before I was halfway there, the man started screaming back at the woman. I'm not sure exactly what she had said to him, but it had obviously infuriated him. Mere moments before, he had taken a quart bottle of Busch or some other cheap beer from the cooler. All of a sudden, he began striking down at the woman's head with it. I'm not sure if he thought it would break or if he intended on hurting her with the nearest thing, but strike after strike he continued. It was a horrifying thing to witness. I blame the entertainment industry for giving people the false impression of how easy it is to break a beer bottle over someone's head. I assure you, it's very hard. Following the fifth or sixth strike, the woman had dropped completely to the floor and stopped moving. The guy stood over her for a moment, but looked up when I assume he heard me running towards him. The second he saw me, he ran out the side door and disappeared into the darkness. The sight of her laying there made me sick to my stomach. The blood dripping from her ears was almost as shocking as the ever-growing pool around her head. It seemed like a bad idea to touch her, so I made the decision to let the paramedics check her for a pulse. When they arrived, she was still alive, but they didn't have much hope for her survival. The cops certainly weren't in any hurry to get there, but when they did finally arrive, 45 minutes later, I filled them in on all I had seen. From the way they reacted, I got a strong feeling that they were very familiar with the two. While on shift, a few days later, my boss called with some news. The female was brain dead, and her family had made the choice to let her pass. The cops had picked the guy up the following night. From the description my boss gave me, he didn't even seem to remember what had happened. The doctors that examined him said that it's likely he truly may not remember what he did, because of the many years of alcohol abuse had possibly destroyed his brain. Sounds like he might not get the full punishment due to him under the law. I'm not really sure how I feel about that. Sometimes, it seems like people really do get away with murder. During my time in college, I had a friend whose dad owned an 800-acre piece of land in eastern Texas. In the past, he leased it out to hunters and paper companies, but was no longer doing it. He had built a cabin on the land a few years before and would let us go out there from time to time to mess around. It served as a great way to relax from the pressures of school and getting closer to nature. The spring break of 1997, we loaded up our trucks and headed for the cabin. Our plans included shooting guns, drinking beer, and other things rednecks like us do in the woods. Our first morning kept us pretty busy cleaning the cabin and moving all our stuff inside. Around dinner, we made a big fire outside and cooked a bunch of steaks and fried potatoes. We skipped dessert and broke open some beers. The sun went down not long after, and for the remainder of the evening, we got loaded and passed around a joint or two. At some point in the night, I heard a shuffling noise outside and went out to check on it. The fire was barely burning at that point, and just outside of its light, I swore I could see the shape of a man standing completely still. From what I could tell, he was facing me, perhaps waiting to see what I would do. I blinked my eyes real hard to get a clearer look, but my position and the lack of light made it hard to see clearly. The shape continued to stand still, so I decided I'd walk up a little closer in hopes of getting a better picture. The thought terrified me, but I was transfixed by the being, or perhaps I was still too intoxicated to make wise decisions. I took two steps forward, but was distracted by a voice behind me. My friend had woken up and noticed the door was wide open. So he got out of bed and saw me walking around the fire. His voice caused me to jump a little, but I soon realized who it was speaking. I asked him if he saw the figure on the other side of the fire pit. He just laughed at me and said I must be so stoned I was seeing things. We laughed it off and returned to bed. On my way, I turned back to take one more look, but the shape was no longer there. I chuckled to myself and went back to sleep. The next morning, I wrote the whole experience off as the result of too much fun and went on with my day. We spent the first half of it fishing at the big pond. Post-lunch was shooting guns and one guy's compound bow that he had just bought. The beers and smoke were broken out after dinner. A game of poker was attempted but soon canceled in favor of another evening telling lies around the fire. On one of my many trips to relieve myself that night, I was spooked by the sound of a stick breaking close by and noped it back to the fire. The look of fear on my face made the other guys laugh their butts off. I tried to explain what had happened, but was quickly reminded that we weren't the only creatures in the woods. The reasoning seemed sound, so I accepted it. Not long after, we were standing around, involved in some deep discussion, and I turned to speak to the guy on my left. What I saw caused me to clench up so tight I could have snapped a steel rod with my sphincter. Standing within a few steps behind my friend was another man I did not recognize. It was like he appeared out of nowhere. What made it creepier was that he was staring intently at the back of his head, almost like he was trying to bore through it with his eyes. I remained frozen stiff. The longer I looked at him, I realized he was the same being I saw lingering outside the light of the fire the night before. He was average height with a long, unkempt beard. My friend continued rambling about whatever, unaware of his shadow. After several long seconds, the stranger turned to me with a blank expression and walked away. This was when my friend finally noticed my horrified look. When he spoke, the thrall of fear was released, and I began pointing and rambling about what I had just witnessed. He and my other friend laughed at me again. There was no way I was seeing things this time. I described the man, and one of them suggested he was a Bigfoot. Despite my protestations, no one was buying it, and I eventually cut my losses and shut up. However, I wasn't beat. Their mockery had made me even more determined to prove the stranger's existence. The next 2 days were quiet. No stranger, in other words, but I kept my eyes peeled for anything out of the ordinary. By our fifth morning, I was beginning to question my sanity. I'd seen this mysterious being stalking around us twice, and now it had suddenly disappeared. I resolved to put my quest on the back burner until some new evidence arose. My friend's dad had mention him, an owner of one of the surrounding properties had spotted a small group of wild hogs running through his land, so we grabbed our rifles and went on the search for them. A mile or so down one of the property's many roads, we came across some hog wallows and knew we were on the scent. We went up the road, now on foot tracking them. Another mile on, we stumble upon three large hogs rooting up the ground and prepared to make bacon. Two of us chambered around as quiet as possible on our rifles and took aim. I was less than a second from saying three and pulling the trigger, when the loud crack of another rifle filled the air, followed closely by a burst of wood and bark above my friend's head. It took a moment for it to register that we were being shot at. A few seconds later, another crack and strike, this time even closer to my friend. We weren't going to wait for a third. The friend who appeared to be the target led us down a side trail that led back to the cabin. No more shots followed as we fled. However, instead of finding safety at the camp, the shots began again. Seeing no other option, we hopped into my truck and hauled it out of there. This was a time just before the commonality of cell phones, so we had to drive the 20 miles to town to get help. After we explained the situation, we returned to the property a few hours later with some deputies. We approached slowly and remained in the cars when we parked. We waited to see if the shots would start again, but nothing happened. A cursory look around counted three holes in the cabin and another two in my buddy's windshield. Perhaps the worst was that all of our camping stuff, sleeping bags and such, were spread out all over the ground. Luckily, we'd smoked everything the night before, so the police were none the wiser. Nothing was missing but a box of 30-30 ammo and, strangely, my sleeping bag and wool blanket. A theory began to form in the deputy's mind that we had stumbled upon a squatter or poacher camping out on the property for whatever reason. They acted as if they were going to let it go, but once my friend's dad, who owned the land, heard about it, he put pressure on them to start a search. This was about the time I repeated my story of seeing someone lurking around the cabin. No one was laughing now, and my story was finally being taken seriously by somebody. The search was led around the property by my friend's dad. School had already begun again by the time it took place. It continued for a full week, but nothing other than a few old camps were found. It was assumed that he knew the heat would be on him after the shooting incident and he moved on. During the course of the investigation, several avenues were followed to ID the stranger like escaped cons, but he remains unidentified to this day. Because of the chance of another attack, our trips to the property ended. The next year we tried to camp out somewhere else, but it wasn't the same and our nature getaways died out. Within 5 years, my friend's dad had a heart attack and lost interest in the cabin. The paper company's lease were renewed and the land's trees have been used to make paper and pulpwood products ever since. Each time I jot down a quick note, I'm reminded of our awesome trips and especially the odd and terrifying week that caused them to stop. I do, once or twice a year, talk to my old college friends on the phone. As far as he's heard, that crazy stranger still hasn't been caught. We sometimes theorize as to his origins and where he may have ended up. I, however, often take this much further when I'm alone. I wonder why our so-called strangers seem to focus so much of his anger onto my friend, and perhaps, far more concerning, is he still out there waiting for his chance to finish what he began all those years ago? I live in a major city in Texas. My apartment complex is gated and in a good neighborhood, but the security isn't extremely tight. Sometimes the gates are left open and anyone could piggyback off of someone else entering with the access code. Maybe twice in the past 3 years, the management has put out notices of vehicle break-ins and other items being stolen from porches. We also have frequent door-to-door solicitors, even though there are signs forbidding it. So this particular Friday evening, I go to bed at about 2:30 a.m. For some odd reason, I was having trouble getting to sleep, so I put on a podcast to listen to and eventually start to doze off. I become aware of a noise that sounds like a clicking sound, what it sounds like one of my upstairs neighbors making some noise. I kinda zone this out, as I'm used to my neighbors staying up late on weekends. After about 30 seconds, I realize the noise is extremely repetitive and getting louder. I then start focusing on it more intently, trying to isolate what it could be and where it was coming from. Suddenly it hits me. It's coming from the entrance to my apartment. I leap out of bed and head to the foyer. I identify the noise right away. The lock mechanism is moving back and forth rapidly, like someone is trying to unlock the front door. I can hear that an object is inserted into the lock and the person is jimmying it back and forth with a lot of force. I instinctively turn around, head to my bedside safe, unlock it with the combination, and pull out my .357 SIG pistol, load a 14-round magazine, and chamber a hollow-point round. I head back to the door, and as I exit the bedroom, I see the lock twist and unlatch. I immediately point my weapon straight ahead, knowing that if someone comes through, I will have to make a split-second reaction. I decide that if someone comes through my door, I will give them a momentary chance to retreat, but if they do anything other than that, or enter aggressively, I'm going to shoot and ask questions later. They don't enter. However, because I had also locked the deadbolt inside only, when I first moved in a year prior, I remember thinking that the deadbolt was a great security feature, and I got in the habit of always keeping it locked when I'm home. In hindsight, this decision saved me from a life-or-death confrontation. Upon realizing that, I approached the door and looked through the keyhole. On the other side are three Asians, two men and one woman. All three are wearing hoodies, so it's difficult to make out their faces. The men have objects in their hands, but I can't make out exactly what. The two men are talking back and forth, probably trying to figure out why they can't open the door, even though they have successfully opened the outside lock at this point. The woman is also talking loudly behind the two men, such that anyone in the hallway would be able to hear her voice. She's talking in another language. The only words I can make out are, blah blah blah, apartment 250, blah blah blah. And she keeps repeating that over and over like a broken record. Upon hearing that, I start to wonder for a moment if maybe they're just drunk and have the wrong apartment number. But that's impossible. To open my lock, they would have to have a copy of my exact key or some kind of lock-picking device. I've never copied my key or even given it to anyone. And here's the other thing. Not only is 250 not my apartment number, but, as I figured out later, that apartment number doesn't exist anywhere in the complex. Standing back from the door, I take a long broom handle and jab it hard in the face of the door, letting them know that I'm on the other side. They immediately stop fiddling with the lock and take off running. I debate whether to call 911 and decide against it until they return. I know they'll be long gone by the time anyone gets there. It would be too risky to follow them to try and get a better description or license plate, and I don't have enough identifying info as it is to make an arrest. I filed a police report the next day and let the apartment management know. They said it was unusual, but they would alert the resource officer and ask for a police presence for a couple of nights. Nothing ever came of the report, but that's not a surprise to me. It's been 7 months since this happened and no further incidents. Nobody else in the apartment has reported anything similar happening. I don't think they'll be back, but one precaution I took was to buy a smart lock for the deadbolt, so I can leave that deadbolt always locked from the inside, even when I'm not home. It's crazy to think that the deadbolt was the only thing between myself and an armed confrontation with intruders. They say you don't really know what you'll do in those situations until it really happens, but I can honestly say I am proud of how I stayed calm and was mentally prepared to defend myself. If there's one good thing that came out of this, I feel confident that I responded the right way and was ready for the unthinkable.